Marlon has worked as a staff member as well as a consultant for HIV/AIDS organisations such as AIDS Project East Bay, the Black Gay and Lesbian Leadership Forum, and both of those are in Oakland, California, and Men of Colour Motivational Group in Detroit, Michigan. He's conducted workshops and delivered lectures and scholarly papers at several conferences and at various institutions, including Harvard, UCLA, UCSD, the Graduate Theology Union, McAllister College, Syracuse University, the University of Connecticut, Dillard University, and Boar's Head Theatre Company. Sarah Clark Kaplan is a PhD candidate in Comparative Ethnic Studies at UCB. Her dissertation title is Unspeakable Thoughts, Unthinkable Acts Toward a Black Feminist Liberatory Politic. She has an MA in Comparative Ethnic Studies and her BA in American Studies. She's the recipient of numerous fellowships and awards, including right now the Ford Foundation Pre-Doctoral Fellowship. She also has a lot of activist experience and work, including being a field researcher in the Welfare, Race, and Gender Equity Project in Oakland. And last but not least, Priya Kandaswamy, and she is finishing her PhD in the Department of Ethnic Studies. She's a graduate researcher at the Center for Race and Gender, and her dissertation topic is on the intersection of race, gender, and class in contemporary debates about welfare reform in the US. Thank you very much.
That's the order.
You want me to start? Okay. That's fine. I'll start. All right, and so I'm Matt, and I'm really thank you all for coming here today, because I think that these conversations are so necessary, and they haven't been happening anywhere. I think that the different voices that we have here today on the panel really kind of speak to the level of complexity and the different kind of many layers in which this issue really needs to be addressed, yet still is kind of working on really simplistic grounds. And so, and we're just looking at one little part here, right? Like, we're just looking at kind of African-Americanness, like, and blackness. And so, obviously, there are various other, lots of other things to say about kind of race and gay marriage and these debates. But for today, I think that it's a great start to think about how these debates have been kind of brought to specifically Black communities, I'm speaking particularly about like some of the representation. So I'm going to show you some footage, and then people can talk about it later. And I'm sure my colleagues will a lot of what they say will have a lot to do with all the variables that we're going to see here. And I don't even know if y'all can see the. You may have to kind of stand up and like while I'm doing it. Okay, so I won't do it for like a couple seconds. So Sarah and Priya and I went to this forum on Saturday at SMAC, which is a queer youth center in downtown Oakland that really caters predominantly to African-American youth. And it was about Black communities and gay marriage. And it was a very interesting like panel of many different African-American queer activists and community members, clergy, so forth. And what, you know, inevitably, like, every voice really spoke about a concern about getting marriage rights and a really positive way of, you know, thinking about what would happen if gay marriage passes through. And so they kept speaking about the 2,000 some odd rights and privileges that come with marriage. You know, one of the things that I kept thinking, and we did speak about this too, was how often I think Black people have a tragic attachment to citizenship. Tragic, because on the one hand, we all know that the U.S. will never make good on its claims, right? Especially the 40 acres and a mule, right? Like, we haven't gotten our 40 acres and a mule. I know I don't have one. And and which is a promise of sharing wealth and power, and that only a token few will ever get, you know, some small amount. And that it keeps the rest of us wanting, right, and anticipation. And something that, you know, as Sadia Hartman kind of speaks to in terms of seduction, this kind of anticipation of full inclusion into the nation is really a kind of seduction into our own subjection. Mm. Mm-hmm. And also what the desire for marriage and the rights and privileges thereof also spoke to me about there's a cynicism on one side, but also a faith in the state to fulfill its promises of inclusion, and the desire to be embraced by the nation. And I think that Black people often are tragically attached at some level to recognition. I don't exclude myself from this. I'm here at UC Berkeley, right, trying to speak about these things, right? So there's something about that, even if it is last in my bio. another thing that struck me is the kind of incredible sorrow that people voiced about Black clergy around the country really speaking out against gay marriage. So there, in March, there was Atlanta. There was a demonstration in Atlanta that included about two dozen Black clergy members that spoke out against gay marriage. And also in Boston in February, there was like three different Black minister and clergy groups that did a joint statement. The Black Ministerial Alliance, Boston 10-Point Coalition, and Cambridge Black Pastors all kind of made their own joint presentation against gay marriage. Now, what I think that we're kind of not seeing in this is also people are not just kind of voicing kind of homophobic blurbs, right? Like, one of the things that happens, I can't tell you how many times people have said, oh, it must be so bad for you being, you know, both Black and queer because, you know, we know that those Black people are so homophobic and it's just terrible for you, right? When in actuality, if you actually look at what the pastors are saying, they're actually kind of responding to something particular, right? They're responding to what kind of white queer mainstream statements have presented as what these issues are, right? Mm-hmm. They're responding to distortions that make easy equations between race and sexuality, mm-hmm. right? And they kind of speak to it, not really. Being respectful of civil rights movement is not really being respectful of black lives. The equations with slavery also, you know, are incredibly disturbing for Black people, both, you know, not just straight Black people and not just religious Black people, but, you know, it's disturbing to me as well. And also, you get a sense from how they speak about it is that there's an exclusion of a Black queer experience, right? They always, in these anti-gay statements, there's always a separation that kind of has, there's, we are Black and they are gay. But where is this coming from, right? This is not just coming from their own personal homophobia, which of course is there, but also it is also coming from the campaign itself, right? The gay marriage campaign itself presents this in its very articulation of we are just like Black people who, you know, sat at the lunch counters and now we have our own, you know, kind of lunch counter situation, or we no longer want to sit at the back of the bus. And so I remember the book that came out about Black women's studies many years ago, not that many years ago, but you know, in the 1980s, all the Blacks are men, all the whites are women, and some of us are brave. I think I inverted that. But in this situation, like all the queers are white, right? And all the Blacks are religious, and all the Black people are also cast as conservative and backward thinking and against the rights of people and hypocritical. I mean, all of that is situated on the shoulders of Black people, and nobody ever takes a look at what white gay, not necessarily queer, right, because they're really coming from like a lesbian and gay perspective, how they couch these. So, and they do these things with real kind of just taking up black lives and movement and struggle. Like, I can just imagine that somewhere in the United States right now, there are all these, like, white lesbians and gays, like, kind of locked arms singing "We Shall Overcome" in front of the courthouse, needing to get their, you know, marriage papers down. And you know that that's happening because I've seen it before. All right, so I actually want to take a look at some of what has been on mainstream media and also some of what's been circulating around. And I as I kind of walk over here, I want us to really think about ourselves as all of us being historians in some ways. I know that I'm old enough to remember the early 1990s when anti-gay initiatives were being kind of set up all over the country, and it was a very similar situation. You had a war in Iraq, and then you had all of these municipalities and states enacting anti-gay legislation all over the country. You had a white gay majority, majority in terms of like representation, speaking out in a way that is incredibly offensive. And so I just find this all to be deja vu, as far as I'm concerned. The first thing I'm going to show is... The first thing I'm going to show is from CNN. And it's about gay marriage, like in the same day, right, like headline news, also had the Fresno case, the case of the black man who murdered several of his own family members. And so what I want to show here is the kind of what black people are, what kinds of representations of black sexual pathology that are kind of reinscribed over and over and over again to the point that... You know, these two stories kind of meld in a certain way. So you have the kind of crazed sexual pervert of a black man, and then the good white queers who are very capitalist and very much part of the nation. Could you, somebody get the lights, please? All right. So I hope we all can hear.
In Fresno, California, and much of it has to do with the relationship between victims and the prime suspect, Marcus Wesson. Wesson has been charged with 9 counts of murder. His bail has been set at $9 million. Police now say all 9 of the victims found in a house on Friday were Wesson's children, one adult and one teenager, frequently used by Israeli settlers.
Okay, so, all right, so that was, so, let me see.
We're learning more now about the multiple homicides.
So, I'm sorry, that went again.
Gephardt and his wife.
All right. All right. So that was the piece about the multiple slayings in Fresno. And you see him being like led out, and there were lots of photographs of him. And it was all about—it was all about a story of incest, right? That the story was about how he had impregnated his daughters and then murdered them. And so all of this was kind of infused about sexual pathology, infused in the story. It's just one of the many kinds and times that when black people are on the news or when black people show up, it's often around these kinds of issues. Either it's this or teenage pregnancy or some other panic, right, about black sexuality. Mm-hmm. All right, and then when you get to see, then we're going to see the kind of gay marriage stuff.
Fire department. Gephardt and his wife, families may find a vocal ally in Congress. Congressman Richard Gephardt and his wife gave public support to their lesbian daughter, Chrissy, and her partner. They attended an award ceremony hosted by the group Parents, Families, and Friends of Lesbians and Gays.
So you see Richard Gephardt right here. I mean, this is like this very conservative white man.
Expect to see more of the congressman on the issue.
Exactly, very heterosexual. And then you see the people in New Paltz, all very white. It's going by fast, but you can tell.
It makes me
now I want to kind of set
set this up. Now, this one is about the exclusion in a golf club, right? There's a country club. So all these, you know, there's this rich, it's like the pursuit of happiness, right? This is all the same day. This is all the same day in CNN. And so here's this white gay man talking about, you know, his pursuit of happiness.
There's really no logical reason for the club not to do this other than prejudice.
Atlanta attorney Randy New is an avid golfer, a member of the Druid Hills Golf Club, and he cares.
This is not a bridge club.
This golf club costs $50,000 to join and $600 a month.
$50,000 to join this
pay a
one
membership
month.
Fee. Spouses are free. But since gay couples are not allowed to marry in Georgia, gay partners have
so this
to pay
is the same
full price,
state
an extra
in which the black ministers are
you
were protesting. So
there.
This is what, you know, is presented about, like, the plight of us gay people of Georgia.
New and golfing buddy Lee Kaiser are in long-term relationships, have filed with the city as domestic partners, and say they would marry if they could. But as far as the Druid Hills Golf Club is concerned,
their
that's not enough.
Out there either,
they are still
actually looks like they're a couple
single.
In some ways.
Because Georgia is one of four states without an anti-discrimination law.
And so, you know, and then so they talk about it.
Wow, they have a lot of golfers.
Issue
a lot of golfers. Okay. So, oh wait, I want us to hear this little thing that she says, because I think it's just hilarious. All right.
It's about the simple things in life.
And what if they go? Oh, golf is part of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
Isn't it? Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness in golf, right? And your $50,000 a year club. $50,000, you know, to join club.
Gulf, right. Florida town officially gave Satan the boot.
Right. Satan got booted out of Florida. Now, this one is from MTV. And so this part is like a part of the MTV News special. And so it had a lot of information about gay marriage and its and the kind of back and forth, the controversy. And so what I wanted to show in this short clip of it is all the footage from the 1963 March on Washington that gets represented alongside an entire array of white people over and over again in terms of queer.
It's not a total one. What's being debated now about gay marriage, which is one important issue, but it's not a total social upheaval the way the civil rights movement was.
So you see the back and forth? I don't know, did you see that? Yeah.
There does seem to be a parallel between gay marriage and interracial marriage, which was once equally divisive. As you consider where you stand on marriage between same-sex couples, consider this.
In 1967, I was born 16 states in the United States of America.
So this is Gavin.
To marry whites to marry blacks in this country. That's in my lifetime.
As preposterous as that might sound to you today, a Gallup poll at the time found that 72% of Americans were opposed to the idea of a man and a woman of different races marrying, and 48% even thought it should be a crime. Numbers like that seem unthinkable now.
Okay, so numbers like that seem unthinkable now, right? This whole sense. No, like, you know, interracial marriage is, you know, completely, you know, absolutely accepted in the United States.
Right.
There is no racism. People who, you know, have, you know, it's all in the past.
Right.
This is all happening.
Now, people will really wonder why there was such a fuss about this. Just as today, young people probably wonder why was there such an incredible fuss about black and white relations.
So the battle over same-sex marriage may be yet another page in the long, inexorable march towards equality.
Here's a timeline of the long march towards equality.
The Emancipation Proclamation.
Starting with the Emancipation Proclamation.
1964.
The Civil Rights Act.
Outlawed racial discrimination in
voting,
education, and public facilities.
Except for Martin Luther King.
1971.
And then the voting age is lowered.
Over time, through these populist struggles of one kind or another, that concept of liberty has expanded. More and more groups have gained freedom.
So here you have the March on Washington. And so he starts talking about this progressive narrative. That it's all the march. There's a march toward freedom, he said. And that, of course, now racism is over. And here's the next hurdle that we all have to deal with.
This is just one more step in that process. And,
one more step in the process.
Irreversible, actually.
Okay. So the next part here is from a video made in the early 1990s, specifically an anti-gay video, specifically targeted at black communities, but also sent out around the country, specifically targeting black religious communities. The announcer, the over voice person is black. It's an identifiably black male voice. And what they point out is exactly, you know, the kinds of distortions that happen where race and sexuality are equated, and they also kind of show an entirely white, right, lesbian and gay movement. But you're getting the footage exactly from queer people themselves.
And when is it?
This is 1993.
Okay. Who made the video?
The name of the video is Gay Rights, Special Rights. And it was a really powerful tool in the early 1990s. And I had to look up on the box exactly who.
It was the 400
Club. Was it the 400 Club? It was something like, you know, Citizens for Civil Rights, actually. Citizens for Civil Rights. Okay. So August 28th, 1960. The exact same footage. Here we have again March on Washington, showing this very long. This is how the video starts. It's the very first day of the video. I'm looking again.
The kind of constitution that we have, it was wrong, just out of pure logic, for black people to be discriminated against solely on the basis of color. The 1964 and 65 Civil Rights Act was clearly something that needed to be done in order to hold up the whole notion of justice in our country. I may not get there with you, but someday we shall enter the promised land where men and women will not be judged by their sexual desires, but by the content of their character. Many fail to notice Mr. Kramer's substitution of the word sexual behavior for skin color, as he misquoted the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. on the steps of the U.S. Capitol. Thus began the 1993 March on Washington for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender equal rights.
The 1993 March on Washington for lesbian, gay, and bisexual equal rights.
Everybody that you see is white. No people of color actually speak in this video until much later.
Seeing immortalized because I have dreams. And for us, this is a continuation of.
And so you have a white person speaking about. Just now, you had a white person speaking about how this all started with the March on Washington, and for us, this is a continuation. Right? And really kind of claiming it as their own.
That the statutes, the laws, all of the advantages gained by civil rights leaders such as Martin Luther King be now applied to homosexuals.
Okay, so
the Hispanic community does not want to be compared with homosexuals.
Government has no business putting a stamp of approval on a behavior-based group, let alone elevated to full minority status.
The high-handed attempt on the part of gay and lesbian movements to hijack the 1964 Civil Rights Act in order to try to give national credence to their moral lifestyle is an offense to black America.
There are a few people willing to stand up and rebut this whole notion.
Okay. And so this next part is really important. This next part is where, and then I'll sit down and other people can speak. The next part is about the a survey put out in early 1991, I think it was, I think it was 89, but then reported on in 1991 by Overlooked Opinions, which surveyed the subscribers to major lesbian gay magazines and asked them about their education level and how much money they made. And so it got distributed widely and is still used by different lesbian and gay groups to get corporate advertising and corporate sponsorship for mainstream magazines and events. So this all came up in the Wall Street Journal saying, here's this well-educated, well-funded market that you're not tapping into advertisers. So what the right wing did was put those very same figures into the video, and they also distributed it in, when they had anti-gay initiatives, in black neighborhoods, door to door, and said, these are the people who want to usurp your rights.
The group must have suffered a history of discrimination resulting in the lack of ability to earn an average mean income, obtain an adequate education, or enjoy cultural opportunities. Compare these results of a nationwide survey reported in the Wall Street Journal.
So here are the good, here are the black people at the 1963 March on Washington.
Average household incomes, percentage of college graduates, percentage of those holding professional managerial positions, percentage of those who have taken overseas vacations. Have either African Americans or homosexuals ever been denied the right to vote? Ever faced legal segregation? Ever denied access by law to public drinking fountains and restrooms? Ever denied by law access to businesses and restaurants?
Their high income, their education, their current status in society compared to the mean or the median income in minority families today, it's just, there's no comparison. So for them to want protection under this law and to try to further beat down the minorities and further lessen their chances of equal protection and equal chances at jobs, I just think is ludicrous.
If you look,
says he's not getting.
So I'm going to stop there. Sure. But people were speaking about the there was an attempt to kind of amend the 1964 Civil Rights Act to include protections about sexual orientation, and so in these ways, right, from the way that white queer people themselves presented what it means to be queer. It was clearly white, it was clearly upper class, it was clearly incredibly privileged, and for black people, the idea that somebody who identifies themselves as being white and privileged already to actually talk about discrimination just seems as a complete lie. It seems as if somebody's trying to take their own struggle and use it for their own gains. It's another way that white people use black people and black people's lives and struggles for their own gain. And so I think that this is something that we can, people can talk about, and I'm sure that others will continue to really put this into perspective around the current debates. Thank you.
Okay. Equality for whom? Gay marriage and the limits of liberal politics. One is always in the position of having to decide between amputation and gangrene. James Baldwin, Notes of the Native Son, 1964. Recently, I saw an advertisement defending same-sex marriage put out by Log Cabin Republicans, a group of gay and lesbian members of the GOP. On their website, they describe themselves as, quote, Republicans who courageously stand on the front lines of today's most important battlegrounds for gay and lesbian civil rights. We are the nation's leading voice for fairness, inclusion, and tolerance in the GOP, end of quote. These are rather bold, seemingly innocuous claims for an organization that is not running short on social, economic, and political privileges. What I found to be most disturbing, however, was their use of the colored only sign in their ad as the backdrop while showing Vice President Cheney spouting out hollow rhetoric about how free we all are to do what we want to do. Those who are familiar with log cabins would say that this is not inordinate behavior from them. And other white conservative and liberal movements, not much distinction here. However, what is disheartening about this pernicious appropriation of symbols and representations of black minoritarian struggles is the absence of a cogent critique from the subjects, black queer bodies, upon which these civil and epistemological violences are being inflicted. And I just want to make a note that I'm not saying that I own this symbol, although I actually do own the symbol because I was in a play that used this. This emblem of white supremacy, even though my black queer body is always situated within it as a signifier and testament to my ongoing subjugation at the hands of the forces that produce it. It is at the expense of black people, whether we attest to it or not, that the discourses, politics, and social relations that this sign represents remain. For the log cabin GOP, their willingness and ability to co-opt and appropriate it reveals the power and privilege that they have within white supremacy. And I'm not talking about typical homophobic response from black clergy, which has been talked about, or black cultural nationalists refuse to come to terms with the ways in which race, class, gender, and sexual oppression intersect and function as sociopolitical subsidiaries of white supremacy. Such critical engagement exposes the residual privileges of heteropatriarchal power within black domains. Instead, there is a need for black queer people to problematize what gay solipsistic agendas, to problematize white gay solipsistic agendas, where we are used to advance so-called progressive aims that are antithetical to our comprehensive interests. Our continual struggles are put forth as a hope for equality for everybody, while the state and those ultimate beneficiaries of the civil rights movement, for example, eschew the inherent hypocrisy of equal rights politics in which those of us who are dispossessed bear the most burden. As black feminist and chair of African American studies at Syracuse University, Linda Cardi said, "I don't know any rich slaves." As usual, dominant discourses have framed this debate in highly simplistic terms. One is either for gay marriage or against it. For black gay people in particular, mainly because of our untenable historical and present relationship with the US state, to say the least, this is a point of vexation. Most black gay people I have talked to are either ambivalent about gay marriage rights or totally for it. But since I have found the national discussion to be particularly intellectually impoverished, totally hijacked by reductive binarism of for or against, I wanted to actually talk to everyday black gay folk, especially those who are ambivalent, and try to figure out why. Additionally, guided by my own antipathy for white supremacy and heteronormativity, I want to take an unpopular position compatible with my fellow panel members, but not with many black gay leaders. I ask, should black queers jump on and end up on the same bandwagon as the log cabin Republicans? Is there not something very fishy about that? Black queers in the poor and working class social strata do not share the same interests as these extremely privileged white gays, primarily men, and I do not claim to speak for the entire community, yet the log cabins can meet with George Bush to talk about their support for gay marriage. Do black gay people get to have a meeting with the President of the United States to express their interest on this issue, let alone any other concerns such as HIV/AIDS, health care, violences of systemic racism, sexism, homophobia, and heterosexism? I would say not. We have experienced the dangers of uncritical alliances with white liberal movements that at the end of the day have difficulty accepting our particular interests in projects that are anti-racist as well as anti-sexist and anti-homophobic. Black and white women split during the suffrage movement because not all white women advocates for equal rights and the abolition of slavery wanted to destroy the racial hierarchy or provide broad citizenship rights to freed slaves. In his recent book, Aberrations in Black Toward a Queer of Color Critique, cultural studies scholar Roderick Ferguson suggests that black people, we are necessarily racialized as non-heteronormative to act and serve as surplus populations in the production of capital. Therefore, as black gay people, policed by our own in order to overcompensate for that pathologized sexual subject rendering, we should not be in the business of fighting for, adopting, and affirming as a part of our struggle for survival the technologies of state regulation of gender and sexual relations. What are the different states involved that are conveniently excluded when the debate is framed in gender and sexuality terms alone? We know that racialization is inextricably linked to gender and sexual renderings. Ferguson's thesis is apropos here. Quote, "We need a study of racial formations that will not oblige heteropatriarchy, an analysis of sexuality not severed from race and material relations, and an interrogation of African-American culture that keeps company with other social formations, and an American studies not beguiled by the United States," end of quote. I do not personally know what Ferguson or Kathy Cohen's position, for example, are on the gay marriage issue for black people personally, but based on my understanding of their scholarship, it produces a skepticism of the intentions of liberal and liberal positions within conservative agendas for their own interests to advocate entrance into heteronormativity in our name. Historically, in order to explain away failed and ineffective socioeconomic policies by design, I might add, the construction of African-American sexuality as deviant and outside of normativity has been occasioned by liberal ideology to argue for the need for a heteronormalization of black people to solve socioeconomic problems. So you have white conservatives and liberals, black people, especially black clergy, and now some black queers saying that marriage and heteronormative constructions of family is the way to gain the legitimacy that will garner us acceptance and therefore full citizenship. Not so. This reeks of the same problems in the civil rights movement. While there were gains made, but in part, the state selected and coerced leadership who advanced interests that did not speak to the diverse needs and experiences of black people. As a result, we said yes to integration without demanding the simultaneous development of black institutions and the rigorous dismantling of systemic political and socioeconomic disenfranchisement that is shaped by racialized gender and sexuality, i.e. higher ratio of poverty among blacks than white. Women make about 72 cents on the male dollar. Black women make less. Affirmative action benefits middle-class white women, small privileged sectors of black community, but large portions of black people it does not do anything for. And note that Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, and the Panther Party, Angela Davis, had to be disciplined and in most cases killed when they waged critiques against the U.S. state as an imperialist power with aims to colonize the world. However, let me point out that a lot of poor and working class black gay people do not express concern about gay marriage. Quote, in terms of the ballroom community, which is the black subculture that I work with in Detroit, ballroom community in Detroit, if it ain't got nothing to do with a trophy, these girls don't care, end of quote. said Father Infinity, an executive director of the Infinity Project, an HIV/AIDS prevention organization. But the trophy represents the pursuit and attainment of life value that ballroom kids are denied by the normalizing apparatus of the state, marriage, and family. Ultimately, ballroom members are consumed by the basic needs like paying rent, directly or indirectly dealing with HIV/AIDS, negotiating their lives with their biological families, confronting and avoiding of the violence connected to racism, sexism, homo, and transphobias. Or they are running a house of their own where they earn recognition, value, and respect from their ballroom peers. Ballroom members reconstitute these practices on their own terms, so to survive the consequences of their everyday multiple exclusions and displacement. Ballroom has its own kinship system that does not totally break from hegemonic kinship norms in the U.S., but it does not totally reify them either. Ballroom members disidentify with heteronormative family as a minoritarian refusal to fight for and function within an institution that does not see them as full valued members. Hence, Ballroom creates its own gender sexual identity system and kinship structures. In the history of sexuality, Foucault warns us that 19th century discourses on the homosexual and other subspecies, quote unquote, enacted technologies of the social controls in the area of perversity. But these discourses also made it possible for the homosexual to speak back in a reverse discourse for itself, demanding legitimacy and the recognition in the sacred halls of normativity, at times using the same language and the same categories and investing in the same legitimizing regulatory institutions to which they have been subjected in order to justify, support, and maintain, for example, the prison industrial complex. The state marks black people as inherent criminals. So do I go work at the prison? Do I become another kind of caretaker for the injustice carried out against black people? Therefore, albeit well rehearsed, the question is, are there ways to resist without capitulating to and relying upon the very same ideological bullets that kill you every day in order to shoot back? Because the state will, does, no doubt, produce new ways and reproduce old ones to oppress black people. I think that is what scholars like Roderick Ferguson, a queer of color critique, Kathy Cohen, radical queer politics that are anti-racist, anti-sexist, and anti-homophobic, and Jose Munoz, disidentification and world making, this is what they are proposing, an alternative way. Granted, this is a very complicated issue, and I am suggesting that we do not, in facile ways, adopt positions that serve the interests of others at our expense just because it looks like it fits into our struggles. I'm not suggesting that the state has any business creating an amendment to the Constitution that would instantiate its regulation of gender and sexual relations for its own exploitative purposes. And let us be clear, this has nothing to do with religion and some sort of preservation of the sanctity of marriage. Marriage has always been all bound up in property and estate rights and social conditioning, containment, and regulation of mainly women, people of color, and poor people for the sociopolitical, and economic aims of the state. I think if we analyze the explicit and implicit meaning of Baldwin's quote that I use in the epigraph, and look at the similar context within which his sentiments emerge, we can forge more radical libertarian politics that do not replicate those politics deployed by the forces waged against us. Thank you.
So I think I'm up. It's such an honor to be on this panel. It's also just so great to get to talk about things that you're obsessed with people who you agree with. So fun. So I guess this is sort of entitled, tongue-in-cheek, What If Hate is a Family Value? And for the next 10 minutes, my goal is simply to offer some fodder for thought on two particular aspects of the fraught relationship between gay marriage and blackness, one of which Marlon also addressed, actually both of which Marlon sort of addressed, and which I'd like to sort of tease out in a little bit of a different way. First, I'd like to problematize the consistent invocation of family on the part of gay marriage advocates, and second, I'd like to consider what the appropriate response to the proposed constitutional amendment banning gay marriage might be. Let me start by saying that I approach this conversation as a scholar of black political culture and black cultural politics of the 19th and 20th century, in particular, political responses to African chattel slavery and its myriad legacies. From this perspective, I find the current attempt by both the self-anointed, predominantly white gay rights movement and the center of the road black gay political community to reappropriate the discourse of human values from the Christian right, troubling at best. And by this I'm referring not only to the often repeated rhetoric of, we're a family just like you, or the, I think, dubious statement that hate is not a family value, but the increasingly common argument that we need access to state-sanctioned relationships in order to protect our families. While there are myriad critiques of family as a social category that can be made, I'd like to address how this social category has not only failed to protect black subjects in the United States from what Ruth Wilson Gilmore would call state-sanctioned or extra-legal violence, but has in fact been a central means through which such anti-black violence has been organized and in whose service it has been deployed. Since the introduction of African chattel slavery to the Americas, the white heteronormative family has depended upon the distortion, dismemberment, disavowal, and exploitation of black kinship structures for its own instantiation. We can trace this starting with the erasure and literal rending apart of black kinship structures for the material benefit of white families in the antebellum agricultural South and industrial North alike. We can follow it through the reduction of black families to collective units of exploited labor under post-Reconstruction systems of sharecropping. We can hear it in the grandiose claims white employers made on the familial love of black women who, despite the protections and rights of marriage, were obligated to provide reproductive labor for white families as well as their own. We witnessed it in chocolate cities nationwide, the malign abandonment of deindustrialized and desegregated urban areas by whites fleeing to better places in which to raise their families, and are seeing it again as the next generation returns to spearhead violent processes of gentrification intended to make those same black cities safe for their families. The current struggle for ownership of the term family values, however, resonates most powerfully for me with the debate set off nationwide in the wake of Daniel Patrick Moynihan's 1965 report on the Negro family. As we all know, the Moynihan report not only blamed the, quote, weakness of the Negro community, unquote, on the, quote, disintegration of the Negro family, unquote, he measured this so-called tangle of pathology against stable black, middle class, and white families by using three primary indicators: incidence of dissolved marriage, incidence of children born outside the parameters of legal marriage, and incidence of female-headed households. Ooh. In the case of the Moynihan report, this emphasis on marriage as the marker of functionality resulted not only in the obvious, the categorization of diverse, complex kinship networks as pathological, but also served as an opportunity for further state invasion into black life through child protective services, aid for families with dependent children, and the active recruitment of black young men to serve in Vietnam on the theory that it would make men of them and thus better heads of family, which I find fascinating considering the constant intersection of, you know, the gays in the military and gay marriage debates. I mean, maybe that's exactly what we're pushing for. Interestingly, as Rhonda Williams has observed,